This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning. Are you looking to engage with regional decision makers, business leaders, elected officials, and industry professionals committed to improving downtown San Diego? Join the Downtown San Diego Partnership. As a member, you'll receive access to exclusive resources, exposure to special programming, networking functions, and additional opportunities unmatched by any other local membership-based organization. Join the driving forces behind the future of downtown San Diego. For a 10% discount, become a member today.
Levi Jeff, let me see if I can do this. All right. Levi Jeffaglione. Jeffaglione.
Jeffaglione.
Jeffaglione.
Yeah.
All right, let me do that again. 3, 2. Thanks for joining us on this Voice of San Diego podcast bonus episode. I'm Scott Lewis, the CEO and Editor-in-Chief at Voice San Diego. I hope you've been listening to all these bonus interviews, and I look forward to hearing what you think. But if you listen to the one with Councilman Chris Cate, who recently was termed out of his job as a city councilman at the City of San Diego, you may have heard our exchange about homelessness. Cate, like all city leaders, said in short that it's getting worse in the city, and he didn't offer much hope about what we would see soon to improve it. Homelessness in San Diego is a crisis. I think it's an acute emergency and we should treat it like a natural disaster. But it's as diverse a problem as the people who are experiencing it. I wanted to talk to one person who had experienced it. Levi Jeffaglione works with the National Alliance on Mental Illness and helps people every day who are suffering on the streets right now. He comes at it with an informed perspective because he used to live and survive on the streets of Los Angeles. He talks here about how chaotic life on the streets is and how so much of what you may be seeing when you come across people experiencing homelessness may be a product of their desire to have some control, even a little bit of control and impact over what's happening around them. I found that point and the conversation with him very powerful. I hope you do too. Here's Levi Jeffaglione. You were homeless at one point, right? Can you tell us the story of what happened?
Yeah. So I ended up homeless in my early adulthood, pretty much right after high school, as a result of coming out as a member of the LGBT community in my family, and also my mom having her own mental health struggles that went unacknowledged and untreated for a long time. So pretty much right off the bat, I struggled really hard at 18. I was working like 60 hours a week and trying to pay California rents. And this was up in LA at the time. And
what kind of jobs were you doing?
So I was trained, a personal trainer, and I also did diet plans for people. I worked at like LA Fitness, Curves for a bit. Lots of different gyms and that lifestyle for a while. So I worked at Universal Studios at one point. That was probably my favorite job, but that was also where things started kind of unraveling, because just in my regular daily commute, I was acquiring tickets for, you know, various things, not stopping long enough. A couple times I got tickets for being on the phone with my bosses.
How long ago was this, by the way?
So this is, we're talking about like 2008. And yeah, everything just got kind of turned into a slippery slope. I wanted to pay my tickets. I hadn't, you know, no idea about really resources at that time other than, okay, go apply for food stamps. And it's changed a little bit now. But back then, they had told me, oh, you have a $100 savings bond. You have to go cash that out and then, you know, come back and apply. So I did that. And then I came back and they said, oh, you're not homeless because you stay in your car. So then I couldn't get food stamps either. And that was kind of like the only, that was the extent of resources that I knew at that time. So
at that point, you had ended up in your car. The $1,800 a month was not something you could keep doing.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't. And then having to pay the tickets, like there was, you know, I didn't know And I still don't think at the time there were any resources for helping people pay tickets, but they were so expensive. Each one was like, you know, half my rent. So I thought I'll move into my car and I'll pay off all these tickets. And it just was a slippery slope from there. And my interactions with the police and getting tickets started happening like every day at that point. So,
where were you parking and sleeping?
At Weddington Park, which is right outside of Universal Studios.
And so you're working still?
Yeah, I was working. And it was above minimum wage at the time.
So I feel like we've jumped really close into like a lot of personal stuff. So I appreciate you doing this and being comfortable sharing. The more we understand how this can happen to people, the better, I think, for the whole community to deal what we can do, to figure out what we can do to stop it from happening and reverse that sort of trend. So you are still working. You're in your car nearby. What's the next step in the progression?
So I was really just stuck in this cycle of grinding it out. I didn't, I was too ashamed to like let any of my coworkers slash friends know what was going on. A couple people did figure out at various times. There was one lady who worked on City Loft and she said, "Can you cook?" And I was like, "Yeah." And so she said, "You can sleep on my couch if you can cook." So I stayed with her for a couple of weeks. Different, like, you know, opportunities where people who had kind of, you could tell, lived through it, spotted it in me. But for the most part, it was very much like a secret that I tried to keep.
Can you spot it in people?
I feel like I've gotten so much better at it.
What do you look for?
I guess it just. I mean, they'll say it in some way or the other. And it's, I do remember like one lady specifically when I was homeless that I spotted it and I paid attention to my intuition. When I was homeless, I would go to the, like ride 6 blocks to the 99 cent store and buy up a bunch of sunglasses. And I would bring them back to the boardwalk and I would sell them for $10 a piece. And this one lady had come up and she was like a little sunburned on her face. She was looking at them and said like, "Oh, I don't have any money, but these are very beautiful sunglasses." I'm thinking they're from a dollar store, but okay. And then the next day she came back, but I noticed she was wearing the same clothes. And so I told her, "You know what, just go ahead." And she was much more sunburned day two. So she ended up opening up to me and I got her some clothes and told her about what resources I knew for people her age in the area. And she told me that, so she was like late 50s, early 60s. And she told me her husband had found a new woman and kicked her out. And she didn't have any family that was still alive. And so that was how she ended up down there with us. But yeah, I guess just being present.
So what happens next?
There was various like bits of homelessness also like around the country where I was young and trying to tell myself like, "Oh, I'm traveling," like, you know, trying to take back some kind of control or like power over my situation.
Yeah.
Like not I'm traveling because I have nowhere to go to, like, but yeah, that was kind of the outlook that I tried to have on it. And so like there was a very long period too where I like admittedly did not know I was homeless. And it was like not until a friend of mine said, he said I was wearing hobo chic clothing. And I said, "Yeah, you know, you got good trends too." And he was like, "Yeah, but it's funny because you're like actually homeless." And I was like, "No, I'm not." And he was like, "Where do you shower?" And I said, "Your house." And he was like, you know, all these various different things. "Where do you cook?" You know, "Well, I can't cook at my place. I go to fast food," you know, and yada, yada. And it, and then there's different levels to it where you're like, there's couch surfing. And then when you're living in your vehicle, that's like another notch down. And then when your head is on cement, that's a whole totally different coming back from kind of thing. So
did you lose your vehicle at some point?
So yeah, I did. I had so many tickets. In addition to just people kind of like partying and like coming out of places drunk and like messing with my car when I was sleeping in it at night, I got way more tickets. And so at one point it got impounded. I had to tell my boss what was going on. And I just remember him saying too, like, "Why didn't you tell me? I could have helped. And I was like, okay, so now I need help. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like, well, I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
So it was like, well, why don't you call your family? I was very estranged from at that point. Ironically, my mom ended up with cancer. So I tried to do the, okay, I'll move back to Mississippi where it's cheaper, right? Like I should be able to maintain and not be homeless because I'm moving somewhere cheaper. I wasn't able to like stay with my mom and her like new family. She had gotten like remarried. And then I was running a gym and I was staying in the back of the gym.
You weren't able to stay with your family because of their concerns about your lifestyle?
Yeah, because it was kind of like, okay, you can come back under this premise of like, I'm married to a preacher now. And so nobody in town can know. And then I didn't do anything, but people in town started to talk, like all 500 of them. So I had to kind of like, yeah, not be there. I ended up doing that traveling thing for a bit and coming back to California. At this point, I had some savings and I had found a room on Craigslist and I was going to rent this room and I put all my eggs in this one basket. And I was still pretty young. I was 19 and I got back. The Craigslist apartment fell through. He didn't tell the other person living there that he was going to like rent out this room. And then, but also he didn't like give me my money back either. And so it was really shady. And basically he told me like the boardwalk is 2 miles that way. And so, yeah. I stayed down there for a long time, And when people came up and they were like, hey, we're here to offer you like some housing. Do you want some help? Like, yeah, absolutely. And I would sit there like, with all of my homies like around, you know, they're all tough and I'm sitting here crying because I'm thinking like if I tell them about these traumas, then I'm gonna get housing. And then there was a part on the VI Spadat at that point too.
What's the VI Spadat?
So the VI Spadat is like a vulnerability index and it's what we use to score who our most vulnerable populations are so that we can get to them and provide them in the most fitting type of housing. But yeah, there's a lot of very personal questions that go along with finding out how vulnerable you are. So, and at the end of it, at that time, it would say like, where do you stay? Like cross streets. And so I put my cross streets forever. I would like not want to leave the block because I was like, no, one of those ladies with the clipboards is going to come back and she'll tell me like they found housing for me. Like, and you know, and like, and it kind of became like a joke after a while that I like still believed that was going to happen. And
you're not working at this point.
No, definitely not working. Yeah, I was in the sand every day and I was so depressed at that point. Like I had really honestly kind of accepted that if it wasn't by my own means, like by suicide, that was the place where I was going to die. Like it just nothing else had like been working out and my unaddressed like PTSD and traumas was just very, very present to everyone but me at the time. So,
how so?
We had like what we called hill families. And so it was like the people who stayed on your block, but it was just also like the people that you vibed with the most to like live with, like any kind of community roommate environment, but just outside. And everybody would like hold each other to these certain rules and like expectations of like clean up your stuff and yada yada. But also at the same time, like they would pick you up when you were down. And I remember, so we had to move our stuff from one side of the street to the other, onto the boardwalk and then back and forth every day. But there were some days where I wouldn't move. I was like lifeless and so depressed that they would just drag me so I didn't get a ticket from the police, you know, and different people like from our family would like come up and make sure I ate and stuff like that. But it was like I had lost like every bit of will to live also at that point too, because I think there was just so much like culminating in feeling like the best way that I can say it is that my mother kind of chose God over me, and coming to grips with that was like intensely painful, but also at a time where I didn't trust anybody like therapist or anyone to talk to. So eventually some outreach workers started coming out, and I still wouldn't like go into their drop-in center. And there was one in particular, Becky, who just knew my name, like would ask me, what do you want next week when we come? And I'd say like, you know, a comb. And she'd say, okay. And like, she'd come back with the comb. Like she would remember the comb, like whatever the little thing was. And then the day that I did therapy for the first time, I had presented so tough and like, I don't need your help. But they had therapy on site. They also had a clinic on site.
What organization?
This is called Safe Place for Youth, and it's up in Venice. And then I started doing therapy, and it just was like, with everything that I was living through on the streets, I was able to kind of process it in real time, because I was like, how do I summarize this for my therapist on Thursday at drop-in? Like, you know, and like,
yeah.
So that came to the point where there was a older gentleman who had gone into psychosis because it was his son's birthday, and I reminded him of his son. And this was somebody like we lived with. He was like in our, you know, community out there. And he just, you know, went into psychosis, and he was trying to stab me. I somehow managed to back away from him for a little bit, and I walked behind one of my buddies and I grabbed my skateboard. And I just took off on my skateboard, and the drop-in center had made me get a cell phone at this point. And so I was skating away, and I was like, as I was skating, I called Becky, my therapist, and I was like, I need to go somewhere. Like, I can't, you know, like, cause otherwise, like, you know, tonight's the night, like I'm gonna die or whatever. She said to me, hey, your friend Alyssa, do you think you can ask her if she'll go with you? And I was like, yeah. So I just skated over straight to my friend Alyssa. I said, hey, OG tried to stab me, blah, blah, blah. I called Becky. She's going to try to get us a room at the LGBT shelter. You want to go? Yeah. So it was like the support that I needed to also be in a different community and with a different family.
Why did it take that to do the shelter for you?
It just was so far, because everybody who had protected me was in Venice, and at that time they had the rapid buses. I just found out they don't have them anymore, but it would take an hour and 45 minutes to get to, you know, my therapist, my friends, my support system.
One of the things I talk about and try to listen for as well is when we're talking about people who are in the street or living in encampments, you know, humans need shelter, yes, but they also need community and purpose. What you're describing a lot of is that there was a lot of problems with it, but you did have community, and that's almost more powerful than shelter sometimes, right? Like, you knew who you were with, you have a rapport, you have a shared story with them,
yeah,
and you experience the world with them. That's powerful, almost more than, like you're describing, than the promise of warmth and shelter.
Yeah. Like, I have clients with SMIs now that are very hard to place in shelter.
SMI?
Serious mental illness. Or severe mental illness. And but those were people that were in our Hill family and that community that I was in, and they weren't always, you know, it wasn't always quite so negative as that experience, but they were like, you know, members of our family that essentially like we looked out for, you know. And if a tourist was making fun of somebody, like, you know, that was our brother, that was our sister, you know. And like, in a way that I just, unless you're taking encampment by encampment, I don't think you can replicate necessarily.
Mm-hmm. So, as in like placing a whole encampment.
Yeah. Like, yeah. One of the things that is like kind of unfortunate about San Diego is because of like the frequent sweeps and them having to disperse all the time. And I don't think they get quite the chance to stay in the communities that they like choose to be in as much.
So this scene you're describing in Venice, you're in an encampment. You have tents. Mm-hmm.
We actually didn't have tents at the time.
Yeah. So one question I've always wondered is, feels like tents showed up in like 2010 or 9. I always relate. It was like this. It seemed like it coincided with the Occupy movement. It's like Occupy showed people you can use tents, you know, to be present as a homeless person, or in even almost a statement itself. Do you have a sense of when tents and why they showed up?
It's so funny because I'm not that old, but it's one of those like things like when I was your age, we didn't get to have tents. I know how much of a difference like tents would have made for us, for sure.
So you're one of the other things that always comes up is like, well, San Diego, LA too, such a warm climate. Like obviously they want to be homeless here. They want to be here, but it gets cold at night. It, even in the summer, it can get chilly, but like it's 45 or 50 degrees out. You're cold.
It is such a, for like a lack of a better word, like privileged kind of thought process, because it's at the end of the day, like California is still a desert.
Yeah.
And we know that deserts are cold at night. Like just because we have like all these buildings doesn't make it not a desert.
Yeah.
So yeah, it is freezing at night. And I always, when I come into work in the morning, to try to absolutely never say anything about me being cold, because they've been in it already for, you know, the last 24 hours and I'm just pissed off because I had to get up. But
well, let's before we transition into the conversation about homelessness, what to do, where we're at, let's finish your story. You, is this the start of you finding stability in housing?
Yeah. So that same organization, Safe Place for Youth, got me essentially like three different housing matches. They weren't all smooth with no bumps. So they got me into the LGBT center. I found out I was having a son. And so really, we had to really start pushing gears there. So when my son came along, it was like, then it was like TAE services also meets like family services. And there just wasn't anything like for us. And then nothing that was close, anywhere near close. So yeah, so they got me into the LGBT center. I had to move out of there. I went to family housing, which that was in Venice. But then...
You mean a shelter for families?
It was transitional.
Okay.
Yeah. So a little bit, you know, better. But still, we all shared community space. And I had some good roommates there. So after that, so DCFS got involved from the time that my son was born. And then ended up getting involved again because I was the victim of domestic violence. And so right after that, pretty much the only route for me was kind of, there was a lot of funding at that time for rehab and treatment and stuff like that. So while I know how fortunate I am that I didn't come down with a substance use addiction, because I saw it happen to so many of my friends. I did partake from time to time. But for the most part, like I went to rehab for pot.
It feels like if you're cold, if you're miserable, if you're in pain, if you have trauma, it seems like a pill that might make you feel better would be attractive. And obviously some of these versus others are so addictive that it doesn't take much. And I struggle with people who talk about the homeless as like, well, they're addicted to drugs and they're suffering from mental illness, because you don't know if that happened and that's why they're homeless, or if they're homeless and that's why some of these problems grew, right? So it's like, so yeah, I was curious, how did you avoid that? Seems like it would be very hard to avoid.
From my perspective, especially because so many of the people that I was homeless with were also very young. So it was like, they would still tell you about what had just happened, you know, with their parents, because it was only a couple years before. So I just think so much of it is it's a symptom more than a cause. In my case too, so I was in Tobacco for Youth growing up. I tried to always play it safe. I like did everything my parents told me. I was trying to be a golden boy. And then right after that, it was like, you know, after I was no longer like welcome in my family, I was living in my car, all of those things that they had kind of told me, oh, you won't succeed, you'll end up homeless, or oh, you'll end up on drugs, or oh, you'll end up doing this. There was one night when I was staying in my car in Weddington Park where all my friends from work, I saw them like gathering in the park, and I was like, oh no, they're going to know I'm homeless. So I got out of the car, and these were housed people, you know? And so they were like, what are you doing here? And I was like, oh, you know, like I just came with you guys, you know? And they were like, oh, well, we're smoking a bowl. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, okay. So in my case, even with pot, which most people smoke pot, I feel like much younger. That even that didn't happen until after I was already homeless, because it sort of felt like, okay, now I need to fall into this criteria of like, you know, I didn't succeed in that society. Now I'm in this society. So the first times that I thank God fentanyl wasn't, I mean, I'm sure it was around, but it was not anything like what it is today. And the drug of choice on the streets at that time was pretty much methamphetamines. And I remember also having conscious decisions to like rationalizing it in my mind, like why I was going to occasionally smoke meth with my friends. And so like one of them was that they would go in the mornings and they would leave me like sitting there and I would get propositioned all the time. Like, and I would be like not even awake, you know, no coffee, and it would get really creepy sometimes.
You mean sexually or for drugs?
Oh, sexually, okay. Yeah. Like bright and early in the morning too, yeah. Just the scenes you wouldn't expect. And so that was part of it where it was like, okay, I'll go in there.
You'd go with them so you could avoid the people trying to come on to you.
Right.
And the whether they're doing drugs or whatever, at least they're not doing that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And they definitely, you know, weren't going to let anybody like talk to me like that around them.
Yeah.
And so I would go with them. And then also when I would get, you know, robbed or sometimes like you could negotiate and like get your stuff back like from the people, like the police and the people throwing your stuff away. But there was also this like kind of mindset, like I got the feeling like, you know, I was very soft. And like I needed to not be so kind because my kindness was taken for weakness. And so that was another contributing factor where I was like, oh, well, like meth makes people like, you know, mean, but tough or whatever. Like I there was like a protective essence to it where it was like I needed to be mean to stay safe. So
again, you're with the National Alliance on Mental Illness, the San Diego chapter. You're housed.
Yep.
What is it that you are doing every day in the community, and what's your mission now, your purpose?
Yeah. So I currently work as a housing navigator. I got my foot in the door about 4 years ago working in homeless services as a peer support, which is just such a great job to go into, not just because it's a job, but for your own recovery. Mm-hmm. It's so rewarding. And then as a housing navigator, I do those VI spadats now, but I do it from a lived experience lens. So I know how traumatizing they can be, and I try to make sure, you know, my clients know you don't have to elaborate on any of this. If you need resources or somebody to talk to after, we go slow, and they know that they can say they don't want to answer certain questions. And I try to always give them realistic expectations of kind of what's to come, because essentially whether they need socks or lunch or whatever, if you ask someone coming in the door what do they need, they're going to say housing. And from that first meeting an appointment with me to the point that they get housing is a very, very long ride. So also through that lived experience lens, I can kind of like brace them for that and be like, build up your support system, you know, like keep your head on straight, like, you know, and some of the kind of tips and pitfalls that I wish some people had told me to avoid. And I also work with lived experience advisors, which was another huge crucial part of my recovery as far as like rehabilitating into society. But lived experience advisors gives me the opportunity to advocate not only on my lived experience and my lens, but also because I'm working in it every day in San Diego, I get to directly advocate for what I'm seeing.
So this, and you're in that role, talking to any group that needs help to understand the issue. Maybe there's a philanthropist that wants to get involved in addressing homelessness, you can provide some counseling or consulting service about what to do and how to do it, right?
Yep. And then also too, just it's miraculous how much of it is just telling our stories, and then
yeah,
you can go, oh, I see why that doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
That we really thought it did in this presentation. like
right. Right now we're in a, and I've been trying to get people to think about this. This is just such an acute and severe crisis that we have. So many people suffering in the streets. We have more every month, it feels like. It feels like the numbers show it. We have this kind of three-dimensional crisis. And correct me if you think it needs to be said differently. But on the one hand, there's a housing availability, just the very cost of living, the rents, the mortgages, the just what it takes. If you're on the street right now and you want to get into an apartment, you have to have like, you got to get like $10,000 together, right? Like to pay all the deposits and the, you know, the monthly fees or whatever months they want you to pay in advance, yeah, just to have the kind of financial security they want to see before they'll let you into a place, right? So the cost just to get into a place is where it's at. It's going up. So we have that housing problem and cost of living problem. And then we have this actual population that is in, and as you said, like a spectrum of homelessness, right? There are people couch surfing. We don't see, we don't know what's going on with them. We have people in cars who are moving around. They're still less visible, but they're still visible. And then we have these vast encampments and street homelessness that's occurring. And that itself is a problem. And then how it interacts with the community is a problem, right? So we have like these three sort of giant, impossible problems, they feel like. And so I want to talk to you about what you would do if you had like a magic wand on each one, but also just like what we need to know about each one. But how long have you been involved in this problem in San Diego?
So really, four years that I've been working in homeless services in San Diego. But then really the last 2 years, I got real bored working overnights during the pandemic and just started researching the heck out of stuff. At some point, I had an inkling that there just might not be enough housing units for everybody in San Diego. And it was, you know, like I said, I was working it overnight and it was like a giant light bulb went off and I was like, I couldn't wait till morning to share my findings with everyone, only to find out that like that was, you know, pretty common knowledge. And so I like the magic wand question because if I were to do one thing, I mean, it would be to wave a wand and have that housing created that meets the regional housing needs assessment, which is closer to 109,000 by 2030. And we need to be doing about 10,000 units per year. Mm-hmm. Right now, the county has agreed to do 10,000 units on their land by 2030. But that makes a huge difference for what we still need. As far as like the mental health, substance use, trauma, any and all of that. I mean, if we waved a magic wand and said, okay, there's no more mental health and there's no more substance use disorder, you know, there's not a place for every one of those people to go today. And then you say, okay, well, it takes time to get sober. Okay, well, like the treatments are like 90 days to 6 months. So still, even if right now today, everybody in San Diego decided to make that move, we don't have the infrastructure to support it. So
we hear a lot, and as you know, I think if you talk to people, there's an impression that the vast majority of the homeless people they see have a substance abuse or mental illness crisis that they're dealing with, and obviously that's just an overgeneralization, has no bearing, but there are so many people who you can see right now, right out in front of our building, people who are struggling. If you were to tell people one thing about what they should know about what they see every day in the parks and in the streets, what would you want to tell them?
There's a expectation amongst this part of our society that sees this society as kind of the only reality. And very much we have deemed the unsheltered people in our communities, like outcast of society. You know, it's
or worse, right? Like almost subhuman, like
right, absolutely. And so, without like ever having experienced what that feels like when you ask someone what time it is and they say, "I don't have any," you know, like, and worse, that's an entirely different reality. And so when people question sometimes like, oh, why, you know, I asked him flat out, like, if there was housing for you today, would you say yes? And he told me no. You know, there's people, I have a friend who's still out there who, she grew up in various foster homes, but she 100% associates housing with sexual trauma. And so same thing with her. If you were to ask her, do you want housing? That's not something that she sees as a crucial need for like the reality that she's been living in. Like, so, that's just the biggest thing. It is. And people say it too, almost jokingly, like, oh, it's like, you know, they don't abide by the rules of reality or abide by the rules of society. Like I always hear that with, them walking in the street. I'm like, that was one of my little things I used to do to just kind of be one suicidal and just to have any sense of like power or control was just crossing the street whenever I wanted to. Cause it was one, like, go ahead, hit me. And then two, it was like, you stopped for me.
Let's press on that for a second. That's a really interesting point. So much of what you've described is something that's also present in other mental health dilemmas, which is this like lack of control. Like you lost control, right? You have no control over anything and you want it and you find it in different ways. And so what you're talking about is when we see some of these moments play out in the street, we might be watching somebody trying to assert some level of control over a world that, where they are completely lost.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was so interesting. I feel like each person in my street family had like their own little flex or their own little way of kind of like asserting that dominance in a sense of like, so my one friend Blue, for example, he would sit on the sidewalk, but he would put his legs like way straight out in front of him. And sometimes like when people would walk by, if they didn't say anything, it was like, okay, but if they would be like, dude, you're blocking the sidewalk, he would be like, I live here. Like, I live here. And he wasn't wrong. He seemed like a total jerk, 100%. But for him, he was like, this is my home. I at least want the space from my head to my toes. Like, you know, and sorry if that's the sidewalk, but this is my home. And I had another buddy too, who when he would, just very, very interesting things, like, you know, a psychologist would just have a field day sitting there watching. But my other buddy, he would ask someone for a cigarette, and when they would give it to him, he would drop it on the ground. And then he would pick it up and go, oops, blah, blah, blah. And he would light it and smoke it. And it would just be kind of a test to see what their reaction was to, like, I just gave you something and you dropped it on the ground. And you know, we all saw him do it over and over and over and over to people, whereas some people just, you know, may not realize, but that was his way of obtaining control in a, like, reality where we just did not have any.
One of the things that I've been thinking about a lot as well is we discussed the tense. To me, when the tense came, a lot of things changed. One was people who were unsheltered felt like they had to hide before, like you said, like, or they were in the parks or in the riverbeds or in the alleys, and that the tents were very clearly, in my opinion, a way to show like control, or like, we're not going to hide from you anymore. We're not going to pretend like, and we're going to assert. It's almost like a protest. That's why I associate it so much with Occupy. It was like, Occupy was this organized, like almost bourgeoisie version of like what is went on after that, which was like just this like widespread ongoing protest in a way. Not that they were necessarily conscious or pushing that explicitly, but that was like, we're not going to move. And But they also represented this longing to have shelter. Like it was, and it changed the dynamics. Like it was like you had to not only just say like, well, do you want to be warmer, to like you have to almost present them a better option. And it feels like the city has taken the opposite path, which was to try to make them as uncomfortable as possible again, to try to, you know, they saw the same thing happen where the tents became just as, or they made it more equal, the shelter option versus the street option. And that their answer to that was, rather than make shelters more attractive or available or whatever, was to make the tents as uncomfortable as possible. And we're seeing, I think, the latest in another year of proving that it doesn't work to necessarily just whack-a-mole them all the time and move them around. That said, like, I also feel very strongly that like you can't privatize public rights of way. Like you can't, whether it's a tent or you know, just a person with an encampment, you can't take a beach or a park and take it for yourself, like whether you're McDonald's or whether you're a person trying to find housing. And so how we reconcile that, I have kept coming back to the idea of, well, I see the need for housing and have pushed it and tried to articulate it as much as anyone. As we wait for that to occur, though, we should vastly increase the number of safe places that we can allow people to have their encampments, their communities, their cars, their car/homes, so that, you know, there are better options for them to do that. But we're focused, it feels like, in tearing the efforts that they already have built for shelter down all the way to where they're as uncomfortable as possible, so that they're forced into the warehousing sort of system that we have. Is that all accurate? Do you feel like that's a representation that I could stand behind?
Yeah. And then I'd add to that too, there's always a narrative too of like looking out for the kids in schools or the kids who want to play in the parks. But like the reality is like even today I saw like there's areas where these encampments form where they are intentionally like not trying to bother anybody. And so like Bynami is one of those, like on 16th Street, you have like us, you have like a sign shop, and then you have MTS on the other side. And then there's really not a whole lot going on that street. 17th, same thing. There's even less, over there. You got Alpha on one side. And so they do like, we'll try to, you know, be in these areas where it's like, oh, like not right next to the preschool playground or whatever. But and then what I just witnessed on my way over here right now is that that area where there's like four different leveled concrete slab lots right by McDonald's, they were clearing all the people right there. And it's like in those instances, it's you know, you're not looking out for business owners or you're not looking out for the children, because you know, dispersing those areas forces them more into neighborhoods and forces them, you know, like on 16th Street, we have the porta potty, right? Mm-hmm. It forces them farther away from restrooms. You know, granted, they are not the most luxurious restrooms, but, you know, that's where they go. So when they're sweeping areas like that intensively, it just really goes against kind of what they say they're doing it for. So.
Let's say you were mayor and I were your chief of staff and we're in office and we say like, we're going to declare this whole situation an emergency, not just declare with some, you know, executive orders or whatever, but like say, like, we're going to treat this as though a hurricane or a tsunami hit and there are thousands of displaced people. What would happen then? We would have vast areas. It feels like with FEMA tents, we would have like, we would try to provide these sort of emergency activities every day. There'd be like a press conference every day about the status of different projects that we're pursuing or the numbers that day. You know, there would be, we would treat it the way that COVID was those first few weeks, right? Where it was just like
the numbers on the screen every day.
Yeah. And in that, if we had like this relentless effort to figure out the safe places where people could go, where we could, as a community, make an accord, like you can go here, leave these areas alone or whatever. We, and then we're relentlessly focused. The numbers could be up there about permanent supportive housing and other different shelter options. And I also feel like throughout history, every time you read a historical biography or something, you read about somebody who was homeless at some point, but they got to go to like a boarding house, or they had a different like minimal housing experience that you could go to.
Exactly.
That we don't have. It feels like you either have enough for an apartment, or you're in the almost the lottery of affordable housing, subsidized affordable housing, or you got nothing. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing at that like very low level. And so if we had just like spectrum of goals, and we had this emergency moment, and we had these safe places where you could go as you wait for your time through it, that would be like a very, I think, healthy system of dealing with this. Do you see a problem with any of that sort of?
No, it's so needed. And it's, I mean, like, let's not be naive. This is not going to be the last, even if, you know, we solve this, this won't be the last crisis that we face. We live in a highly flammable wildfire area. We have earthquakes here. The refugees are not going to stop coming, and they also will contribute to our homeless numbers because not being able to get work, et cetera, right. Everything that goes along with that. We're not prepared for obviously this existing emergency. We knew that we weren't prepared for COVID, and God, we need that foresight, because even the goals, you know, don't quite acknowledge the needs of our community. So
the mayor said something the other day. He's seeing, and I'm sure you're seeing it on the streets, this explosion of deaths associated in particular with opioid and fentanyl use. And opioids in particular have terrified me over the last 10 years because of what they do to people like you. And I'm sure, I don't think people quite understand it. It's not like they're getting high and then they go too far and they die. If they don't get, after a certain level of dependence builds up, if they don't get the drug, they feel as bad as possible, right?
Like, yeah.
You feel as sick,
like you're dying,
as possible, as painful as it gets. And you'll do anything at that point to try to deal with it. That's the dope sick phenomenon, right? And I feel like if more people had a grasp of just how desperate that gets and why that creates so much ongoing dependency and why it's so hard to get people off that, that until you really grasp just how scary and painful that experience is. And yet, so we have the mayor, he came out the other day and said, like, we need to up the consequences of dealing these drugs. We need to do a bunch of sort of vague things that, you know, to really ramp up enforcement along these lines and try to do it. It feels like to me, we're dealing with almost a different virus in a way. Like, this, the spreading of this dependency is itself like a virus. And if you're not compassionate about the people who have it, it's going to keep going.
Absolutely.
And that also may apply to, like, you know, I think we all want to go after these dealers, but that's going to create its own consequences in a way. So how would you, if you've seen what's going on in the street, you've dealt with mental illness and seen it from a lived experience as well, what is something you think could be done about that particular problem? And the ongoing struggle with drugs, because we have had throughout history periods of intense homelessness throughout San Diego. But I think that this adds a new dimension of like severe, almost poisoning of an entire demographic.
Absolutely. Yes. There's so many things to touch on here, but fentanyl is like laced into everything now too. There was one day that I had to Narcan and revive a guy. And as soon as he sat up, because, you know, he had no idea what was going on, he thought that me and the other gentleman standing next to me had robbed him. And then the guy yelled at him, he just revived you. He just saved you. And like I said, the guy said, I don't do H. I don't do Fetty. I just smoke meth. But there was enough of that in it that he had OD'd and was just so shocked and really just thought we came up with the best story for robbing him ever. But and then so that creates even more complexity to the issue because opioids require medical withdrawal because of that feeling like you're going to die because you can die withdrawing from opioids. And then when it comes to low-income people and people on Medi-Cal, we only have one detox facility as an option, and that's McAllister.
So let me just – what you said is actually very profound and troubling. If we have thousands of people struggling with what is, in effect, a physical dependence on this drug, that if withdrawn, would cause severe pain, if not like just – unimaginable behavioral and sort of desperation impacts, that the only option we have one place for those what could be like 20,000 people in San Diego that are acutely and directly right now dependent on that high level opioid.
Yeah. And as a whole, I believe it's 15% of San Diego's population suffers from some type of substance use. So we're just, you know, in no way prepared. And then it comes down to that same thing of being ready when someone asks for the help. So if that day that I was skateboarding after the guy tried to stab me and I called Becky and I said, okay, like I needed somewhere to go. If she said, okay, I'm going to call some places and they'll let me know. We're going to call every morning for the next 3 days and see if we can get you a bed. Like I would have been dead and like, you know, or realize like, you know, you failed me or whatever, but being there, like being ready when people are ready to make that decision is so crucial. And it's just really unfortunate for the housing navigator piece and the case management piece that, you know, it's not, and it may be somebody coming in for the day. And when they say, oh, I wanted to get into rehab, we already know because we called it 9 o'clock for somebody trying to get into a rehab. We already know that it's full, you know?
So that might be part of the emergency plan we put together is like three more places
absolutely
to get people into when they're ready to go through that medical withdrawal. Levi Giafiglione, thank you so much for coming in.
Cool. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast recorded in San Diego that is edited expertly by Nate John. It's the most popular public affairs podcast edited by Nate John. Keep up with everything we're doing with The Morning Report. Check it out and subscribe at vosd.org/morning. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and Editor-in-Chief at Voice of San Diego. Nate John is our producer, also editor of this show. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon.